Welcome to Pivot Matters. I'm your host, Jeff Flynn. Thanks for tuning in today. On this show, we talk about the ever-changing landscape of healthcare payments and the impacts to healthcare payers, providers, and consumers. You can follow the conversation on Twitter at hashtag Payment Matters and follow me at Jeff P. Lynn. Really excited to have the guest for today's episode is Dave Terry, CEO of Archway Health, a one-stop shop for risk-based programs, including bundled payments and alternative payment models, helping all types of healthcare providers build a program that's right for them. Dave, great to have you on the podcast today. You know, for the listeners out there that may not know much about you or the company, maybe tell us a little bit about your background and experience and how you got into becoming the CEO of Archway Health.
Great. Thanks, Jeff. And thanks for including me and Archway in your podcast. We're excited to be here today. Yeah, so my background, I've worked with provider organizations throughout my almost 30-year career in healthcare. I worked with as a consultant to large health systems across the country, as well as an executive within a handful of sizable acute and post-acute provider organizations. And most of that time has been around different types of care and risk management initiatives. So starting off with helping providers prepare for managed care contracting, really in the first run-up of managed care back in the early 90s, doing things like physician relationships and physician alignment, mergers, acquisitions, operational restructuring, direct contracting activities between payers and providers, and then helping them prepare to perform within risk contracts. And so in the early days, it was really a focus on global capitated contracts and, you know, PCP attribution and developing those types of arrangements, and then working directly with our providers within organizations that I was involved with, like Partners Healthcare in Boston and Harborside Healthcare, which is a large post-acute healthcare system, working directly with the providers around pretty specific blocking and tackling and kind of reducing hospitalization rates, reducing ER utilization, generic, moving toward generic prescribing, thinking about, you know, different ways to manage radiology, you know, all kinds of things that people still talk about in terms of helping to reduce costs, but also thinking about, you know, what that means for quality and outcomes. I started Archway with a few folks in 2014, and our focus really has been thinking about specialty care management and how to partner with specialists and specialty providers to improve care for patients when they're sick. Could be an acute episode like a bypass surgery or interventional cardiology, like putting a stent in or a knee surgery or a delivery or something like that, or, you know, an episode of cancer. The reason we really decided to focus on specialty care was the experience I had both in the acute care world and in the post-acute arena. We really struggled to manage in a capitated environment and with a PCP attributed model, or, you know, what we call now an accountable care organization. And one of the things that caused that struggle was it was very hard to engage the specialists and get them to focus on how to improve care, reduce costs, improve outcomes, improve the process for their patients once they got sick, right? And so this is not rocket science, but, you know, patients need the most care and the most attention and utilize the most resources and spend the most money when they're sick, you know, when they're with a specialist. And in most of the capitated programs or ACOs that I was involved with, we still paid the specialists on a fee-for-service basis. So, you know, the primary care physicians may have been capped, but specialists got fee-for-service, hospitals got DRGs, SNFs got per diem, and the alignment was tough. And so, you know, our data says about 75% of the healthcare dollar is controlled by specialists. And so we are really focused on identifying what does great specialty care look like and how can we encourage patients to utilize services that are really good and identify providers who are really good at what they do.
Got it. It sounds like it's a big impact here, especially if it's 3/4 of the expenses is controlled by specialists. This is an interesting topic, especially we're hearing a lot more about ACOs and bundled payments. And I think a lot of people understand the notion of a fee for service. Can you maybe talk about the payment construct of what's the difference between a fee for service and how would you compare and contrast that to a bundled payment?
Yeah. So in fee for service, as you probably know, and many of the folks listening know, each individual participant in the process gets paid for what they do. So it's almost like a piecework concept. So if I'm responsible for primary care components, I get paid for that. And then if one of my patients gets sick, I refer them on to an orthopedic surgeon who is responsible for what they do. And then they refer them on to a physical therapist or a SNF who's responsible for the next step. But the accountability and the responsibility for actually helping the patient get better and back to baseline health status or back home or whatever that patient's goals are, it does not rest with one single person. It's pretty disjointed in that way. And within a bundle payment structure, you know, the bundle payment model is really focused, like I mentioned earlier, on patients who are with specialists and have some are in the middle of some sort of acute event or chronic illness. And that model, when it works best in our experience, you've got a single specialist who's an expert at what your particular clinical condition and needs are, and they're in charge of your experience and your process from beginning to end. And they're accountable financially. They're also accountable for, from a quality and outcomes perspective. And what I love about that model is now you've got one person who's an expert in your need, who is working with you to get you better and back home or better and meeting whatever your goals are. And that doesn't really exist in fee-for-service. And in a bundle payment, our goal is to, like I mentioned earlier, find specialists who are great at the specific need that that patient has, who can help them get from diagnosis all the way through meeting their goals and getting back to, you know, their top line health status.
We've heard in the industry a lot about the amount of out of pocket from a consumer, and you know how that's growing. Stats range anywhere from $400 to $600 billion is out of pocket annually from a consumer perspective. In terms of these new programs that you're rolling out here for bundle payments, especially with these specialists, how does that impact how a patient would pay or the impact on how much they would actually pay in these models?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think theory is still ahead of practice, to be honest. Most of these value-based payment programs, whether it's Medicare programs or, you know, commercial initiatives, are still pretty opaque to the consumer. You know, you won't see providers advertising or marketing that they're, you know, participating in a bundle or they're part of an ACO or those types of things. There's some activity around reference-based pricing in some markets where that is becoming a little bit more transparent to the consumer. But for the most part, these value-based care initiatives are still kind of behind the scenes from a consumer perspective. I do think that will change in the not too distant future, but for now, that it's still, you know, most consumers are still approaching the healthcare system as they always have, and kind of paying whatever shows up in the bill that ends up at in their mailbox.
In terms of as you see more of these value-based initiatives out there and more of these new payment models occurring, what's your sense of sort of the adoption timeframe today of, you know, how many providers are actually participating and where do you see that adoption curve happening in the next 3 to 5 or even 10 years?
Yeah, so there's data out there that says there are about 25 to 30% of providers across the country are participating in some type of value-based care arrangement. Could be an ACO or a bundle payment contract with Medicare, could be like CPC Plus, could be an upside-only value-based care arrangement where they're not really taking risk on the downside, but they've got some enhanced, you know, revenue opportunity. So, you know, the data we've seen looking at both Medicare and commercial, somewhere between 25 and 30%. I do think that that's going to accelerate, mainly because Medicare is really driving this. Medicare and the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation have been the biggest drivers and innovators in the value-based payment world, and they continue to be. One of the big changes, I think, in the last year, the leadership at CMS has said that their goal is to have 100% of providers in a meaningful downside risk arrangement by 2025. And, you know, right now maybe we're at, you know, 25% or so. So that's a massive shift moving from, you know, mainly fee for service to Medicare saying we want everyone in some sort of arrangement. And that rhetoric sort of started to come out last fall, and they've followed through by just in the last 3 or 4 months launching a whole host of programs, some of them voluntary, some of them mandatory, for providers to move providers in that direction. So they've got 3 direct contracting initiatives, which essentially is the the new version of the accountable care concept. They've got couple primary care first models. They've just announced a mandatory chronic kidney disease program, a mandatory radiation oncology program. They just had an open window for the bundle payment care improvement initiative. So they've launched a bunch more programs, and we spoke to some folks there a few months ago. There's, in addition to all the ones I just mentioned, they said they've got a dozen or so others that are in development that I think will be rolling out over the next couple of years. So they're pushing in a big way in this direction, which I think is ultimately the catalyst to make this happen. And when Medicare pushes, the Medicare Advantage market and the commercial market tends to follow.
Yeah, got it. It sounds like adoption is starting to happen, especially with CMS kind of encouraging and almost mandating this. In terms of, you know, clearly there's a financial, hopefully there's a financial benefit tied to this. Are you seeing any financial or positive results for these programs that have been rolled out? And for the listeners here, if there's something that you can highlight here that successes that have occurred due to these bundled payment models.
Yeah, absolutely. So in our experience, when we can get specialists engaged in a bundle payment program, and so we do a lot of work in cardiology around stents and bypass surgery and chronic congestive heart failure. We do a lot of work in cancer with Medicare patients across almost all different types of cancer and cancer types, and work with a lot of oncologists. And then we do a lot of work in orthopedics around joint replacement, shoulder surgery and different types of spine surgery and different types of surgeries in orthopedics. We do some work in gastroenterology and pulmonology. And in our experience, when you can, you do what I described earlier, which is get that specialist in charge of the whole process, really shepherding their patient through the episode, we're seeing savings ranging from, on the low end, 6 or 7% per episode, and on the high end, up to 18% per episode, with an average of about 10% per episode. So that's pretty significant. And if you, I would say these programs aren't yet at scale, but what's great about them is CMS has made a tremendous amount of data available. There's more and more commercial data that's available in the market, and we can use that information to see where there's variability, where there's opportunity for improvement. We share that data with clinicians who then can dive in and identify, you know, what they're doing well and what they can do better based on kind of an absolute basis and also a relative basis to benchmark performance and those types of things. And I'd love to share a couple of examples
absolutely. Okay. Yeah, that'd be great.
So
yeah.
the way the oncology care model works, which is a 6-month cancer episode for Medicare patients, voluntary program. But in our experience, we've got about 1,500 oncologists we work with across the country. When they're involved in this program, they're now responsible for everything that happens to the patient over that 6-month period, not just when they're in their office or when they're getting chemo or infusion, those types of things, but they're responsible for things about all the ER visits, all the hospitalizations, everything that happens, whether it's directly related to the cancer or not. And one of the things that we found was the single biggest reasons for why patients who are on chemo get admitted to the hospital is for sepsis. They're on chemo, they're immune suppressed, and they get an infection. Not a single one of the oncologists we work with knew that that was the biggest reason. Now, they're all really smart people, and they knew that their patients were getting admitted for sepsis, but no one knew that it was the number one reason, right? So in other programs, we actually work to manage patients with sepsis. So we started connecting the oncologists with infectious disease doctors and other experts to try to think of how do we avoid sepsis for patients who are on chemo, and what proactive programs can we put in place, you know, to do that. And a lot of times in fee-for-service, an oncologist might say, well, you know, I don't know anything about sepsis, so that's someone else's responsibility. But in an episode, that becomes a responsibility of that doctor who's on point. And then there are things that we can do to avoid that. And we're not suggesting we're going to eliminate sepsis for people on chemo, but if we can get a 20% improvement, that's obviously awesome for the patient because sepsis is horrible. And it reduces a lot of costs. And so just the focus and the data and the expertise, I think, can really move the needle on a lot of these things. And we see that over and over again, right? Because by getting everyone to focus on the full continuum and thinking about the full health of the patient, it just creates a lot of opportunities for improvement.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Payment Matters. I'm joined by Dave Terry, a CEO of Archway Health. So Dave, I want to follow up on that, which is, great data, great, you know, case studies that are out there. Sounds like a positive win-win, not only for the patient as we look at this, especially that sepsis, you know, example where that was shared with the oncologist. So it sounds like a lot of positive. So what are the headwinds you see in terms of more providers getting on board with these bundled payments? What are the things that are kind of slowing down adoption, or are there things, are there, you know, technology items that are out there that are preventing quicker adoption of these bundled payments? Love to understand sort of what are you seeing as the headwinds that are preventing faster adoption and more adoption of these solutions?
Yeah, and I think it's true for bundled payments and accountable care organizations or any type of value-based payment model that you know, moves us away from fee-for-service into kind of more models that have, you know, more accountability and just much, much tighter management of the process, right? So I think there are a number of things that are barriers to adoption. So one is change is hard, right? I mean, in any industry, you know, you get paid, and it's not just change, it's change how you get paid, right? So I'm in a business, we're going along great, we're getting paid, and things are going pretty well. You're going to tell me you're going to completely change my incentives and the way I get paid in my next contract, and I'll have to completely reorganize my organization to make all that work. That's really hard, right, for anybody who's been you know, running an organization for a long time in a certain way. You know, that would be one. The other is, you know, very frankly, I think fee for service works very well for a lot of folks. You know, there are participants in markets across the country who have done very well in the current model and you know, reporting to boards and people who are responsible for performance. It's hard to say, well, we did well in this model, but we're completely going to change what we're doing things. So I think those are a couple barriers. And then just in terms of the actual blocking and tackling and then making, you know, driving these improvements, it's not necessarily the same systems, the same people, or even the same clinicians that are succeeding in the model today that will succeed in the model in the future, right? So when you think about people, processes, and technology, you know, a lot of that will change to be successful in a new model, and that's scary and it's hard, and I think a significant barrier.
Got it. Those barriers are real, I think, across any industries. You know, of those barriers here, how does, you know, what's the role of Archway Health in terms of how does your company help in sponsoring and supporting the broader adoption of these value-based initiatives?
Yeah, so thanks for asking. So I think in a couple different ways. So one is with data. So we have a tremendous amount of data that we've gotten from Medicare and other commercial payers and some internal operations data from clients that we work with to help them see how they're performing in general in specific clinical areas, specialty areas, what that performance looks like over time, how that compares to their peers in their markets or across the country, and then also who within their organization is doing a great job and who's not necessarily doing a great job, and then what that means for where they can improve, right? So they're just kind of identifying, you know, really on a objective basis, what does performance look like, and where, and on a health risk adjusted basis, which is important in our business, what does their performance look like, and how does that compare to, you know, what great is or what at least best in the industry is. The second is, so we have become essentially an insurance company. So we provide, you know, this, another scary part of this and then a barrier to adoption is risk. So you're going from fee for service where you're going to do some work and you're going to get paid to now where you're going to do some work. And if you do it well, you could make potentially more money than you would make in fee for service. But if you don't do it well, you could lose money. And so that risk component is very scary to folks. And so we are now providing essentially stop loss coverage to providers who are getting into risk arrangements. And so in addition to helping them improve, we're also saying, you know, you're getting into a risk arrangement and maybe, you know, in this agreement, you could lose $10 million in a year. If that's beyond what your appetite for risk is, we can develop a product for you that would cap that risk at, say, $2 million with assuming you're going to implement some things to improve. And then obviously there's a premium, you know, an insurance premium component to that. But a lot of what we hear from CFOs and chief risk officers is, you know, we want to be in these programs, but we also can't be in a position where we're going to lose our shirt. And so we can provide
essentially underwriting capabilities for folks who want to get into any program, whether it's an ACO or a bundle payment program or a commercial risk contract or some sort of carve out or something like that. We will underwrite that for them.
Got it. That's interesting. As I heard you talk about data, and I imagine data and risk have a close relationship here. I remember talking to some Silicon Valley executives, which is perfect data is impossible to get, and you need to have a lot of volume. You need to have a lot of it, the velocity of that coming through, and the variety of that, just to make sure you can actually create some good business decisions. But in the healthcare space, I think we've had some, it's been a little harder to get perfect data on everyone, and love to understand, as you're kind of building these models and doing these data sharing across their specialists and across the healthcare continuum, how are you managing data, or how do you view data, and how, you know, how interoperable or how well are we doing sharing the data across the healthcare continuum today?
Yeah, no doubt it's not perfect, no doubt about it, but it's getting much better, right? So access to information is getting much, much better. And you know, the way we think about data and risk is we kind of create three different categories. So the first would be, you know, programmatic risk or contractual risk, right? So if you think about the oncology care model program that I mentioned, or the new chronic kidney disease program that just came out, those programs are complicated. They have specific rules and incentives and biases in them. And so we're very focused on really trying to understand how those programs work, what the incentives are, how they model out, and get a sense of where the opportunities and risks are within a particular program. And we use, you know, large national data sets to do that modeling to say, you know, what are the incentives and biases in this program, and where does that create wind in someone's sails versus wind in their face, right? So deep understanding of the program, and data is super helpful with that. The second component is what we call provider performance risk. And that is trying to get a sense of what does historical performance look like for an individual provider. Could be a health system, could be a physician organization, could be an individual physician. But what does their performance look like as it relates to specific, you know, specialty type of services? And then how does that performance compare to the rules of the program? And, you know, if provider A were to enter into this initiative, what's their probability of success? And then also, what do they need to change in order to make themselves more successful? So if they need to think about what their readmissions are, you know, how much improvement would they need to have in readmissions, and where is that a problem? Is that a problem in cardiology or oncology or orthopedics? And then what specifically should they be doing in oncology if that's where the problem is to make those improvements? So, you know, again, the data is not perfect, but we spend a lot of time with the data. We also spend a lot of time once we identify who looks, you know, how these clinicians are performing, sharing the data with them and talking to them about, you know, why they're doing it the way they are, and is that great, or is there opportunity for improvement? So diving pretty deep into, you know, what the data is telling us and what, you know, where there are opportunities for improvement in partnership with, you know, with the clinicians who can, you know, use the data in lots of different ways. The third area we'll look at is just pure insurance risk. So what's the sample size? What does the bootstrap analysis look like in terms of, you know, probability? Is there enough sample size for a provider to even get into a program like this, or should they avoid it because they're just too small, or this, or overall, or in this particular clinical area?
Dave, this is really insightful and really interesting to hear you and all the work that you guys are doing at Archway Health. I'd like to end with this last question, which is, you know, there's a lot of ills in healthcare, not only from the patients that are being treated as they're being cared for, but also, you know, all the things that tie to payment and payment reform. And I'll kind of couple that with the fact that you hear a lot about disruption, that healthcare needs to get disrupted. Do you think healthcare needs disruption? If so, sort of what are the one or two things that you really think should happen in order for healthcare to be disrupted?
I won't comment necessarily on whether healthcare needs disruption. I think healthcare is on the verge of being disrupted, whether that's good or bad. I think I think that probably depends on where you sit in the continuum here, but I think it's on the verge of being disrupted. And I say that because, you know, and I've been doing this for a long time, and I've talked to my friends who I've been doing this with for a long time, and many of us have been saying for a while that you know, healthcare is ripe for change. But I do think we're at a different time here. So and there are a number of factors. So one is just how much money we're spending on healthcare as a nation, and as at the macro level as a nation, at the micro level as individuals and the companies that we work for. You know, 19-20% of GDP or something like that, and all the things that it's now starting to crowd out in different households and for employers and as a nation. So, you know, I'm not sure. So I think folks are feeling that we've reached that or close to that maximum capacity of kind of what we can spend. That's one. The second would be just how much data there is available in the world today, whether it's healthcare or entertainment or transportation or all these other industries that have been disrupted because of the availability of data and new technology tools, mobile tools, internet, all those types of things. It hasn't really hit healthcare yet, but the level of money that we're spending, you know, I was looking at a consumer study recently that ranked about 50 different industries across the country in terms of consumer satisfaction. And healthcare, literally about 50, healthcare was fifth or sixth from the bottom, right? So consumers aren't happy, purchasers aren't happy, we're spending a lot of money, lots of other industries have been disrupted, there's all kinds of new data out there and technology. But I think those factors are going to drive disruption. And you see it with Amazon entering our business and Walmart being very frustrated and coming up with new ways to do things, and GE. You see what Medicare is doing and all the things they're trying to do to make change. So whether it's good or bad, I won't necessarily comment, but I think it is here.
Dave, I'll say thank you so much today for being my guest today. And where can our listeners learn more about you or your company?
Yeah, so go to our website, archwayhealth.com. You know, we're continuing to be out in the market working with providers who are getting into these programs. We're working more and more with providers who are taking risk of different types and helping them, you know, underwrite that risk. And then we're starting to work more directly with self-insured employers who are trying to solve the problem for, you know, helping their employees get high quality, high value specialty care using some of the same tools that that I described that we're using in Medicare. And so, yeah, check us out at archwayhealth.com.
Great. Well, definitely for all the listeners out there, those are the payment matters we're tackling today. And go to archwayhealth.com to learn more and connect with Dave Terry and his team doing great things in healthcare. So just a reminder here that you can listen to these episodes weekdays at 4:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m., and 8:30 p.m. Eastern. You can also listen to these podcasts on Apple Podcasts and Google Play Music, or just say, Alexa, play Healthcare Now Radio. If you have a comment about the episode of the show, please follow hashtag Payment Matters or connect with me on Twitter at Jeff B. Lynn. You can learn more about my show at healthcarenowradio.com or at insmed.com. Until next time, I'm Jeff Lynn.